Well, good morning and welcome, everybody. Oh, that's maybe still a little bit too loud, huh? I'll turn it down. It's not too bad. Maybe a little bit. This is Bio 231, and it's the 15th of February, and this is the first lecture of the week, even though it's Wednesday, because last time you had a test. And all your tests are graded, and I put the Wednesday's lab sections in Blackboard. And I'll put the other two sections, the Monday sections, in later this afternoon. But if you want to see your tests, of course, you're more than welcome to stop by office hours tomorrow. Otherwise, we probably have some time during lab to do that. So this week, we're looking at your practicums. And then next week, you'll have time to look at your lecture exams as well. And then Blackboard then automatically calculates what your overall score is, adds up your points, and tells you, if I had to give you a letter grade today, what it would be. Okay. I noticed that it was really pretty startling. There were a lot of excellent grades on the practicums, a lot of A's on the practicum, even a number of 100%, which is really good. Congratulations. That means you really applied yourselves and studied for that practicum, which was really good. But then I noticed that the lecture exams didn't match up exactly with the practical scores. They're not quite as good as the practicum. And I think maybe the practicums are a little bit harder. So I got a feeling that some people studied really, really hard for the practicum and didn't start studying for the lecture test until after the practicum. And guess what? That wasn't enough time for you. So just remember, if you do have a practicum and lecture exam, which you pretty much do, scheduled really close to each other, maybe over a weekend or something that separates the two, that you got to keep pace with the lecture material as well. And that's what Blackboard is designed to help you do, is to keep current, right, keep you on pace so that you don't get behind in lecture. Sometimes you get a lecture exam before the practicum, and then be concerned that you're not just studying for the lecture and putting off the practicum until it's too late. So you kind of get work with those two things together. That's the only thing I can say. But the lecture exams were pretty good, but the practicums were really, really, really nice. All right, does anybody have any questions? Don't forget, in Blackboard, the lecture exams are labeled E, and you're going to get 5 of those. And the practicums are just labeled P, and you're going to get 5 of those. And then lab quizzes are LQ, 1 through 10, because you're going to get 10 of those. And then the online quizzes, I forget what they're called. Weekly quiz or something. Okay, and there's 15 of those. So you got a lot of points in this class, which is good, which means that you could probably bomb a test or a practicum, but there's so many points you can recover from that. The thing that you can't recover from is if you get a 0 on a test, right? So make sure you don't get a 0 on any test. Yeah, question. It says the test is just graded if the answer's right. I give you 2 points for a lecture exam. And then I just add up the points, and then it's a straight 90, 80, 70 scale. So usually curving means that you take the top 5% and give them A's, you know, and then the next 10% B's, and then the next 20% C's, and then the next 5% D's, and everybody else gets F's. No, because a lot of people, actually I get a lot of A's in the class. So if I grade on a curve, that means I would jip a whole lot of students out of an A if I were to do that, right? So if you get a 90% or above, that's an A. Even if the whole class gets above 90%, the whole class would get an A. So I would feel bad if the whole class got above 90%, but I only gave 10% of the students an A. That would be kind of bad. So it's just a straight scale. I don't curve, okay? Okay. All right, let's see if that microphone will behave. Any other questions? New? Okay. You know, in Europe, what you in a class like this, you know how many tests you get?
One
at the end of the semester. All right, so I like to have more tests just because it breaks information up into smaller bits and pieces. And on this first test, there are 80 questions, but on subsequent tests, there'll be more questions. But I kind of like that because that means if you miss 5 questions and there's only 50 questions, that almost drops you to a B. But on a test that has a lot of questions, right, if there's 100 questions, you can miss 10. So more questions, the better, but you have to be a little bit, you have to have enough time to do the test. But I don't think anybody ran out of time on this first test that we have. So Next test, more questions, more chances to get course points, which is good. Okay. All right, so we're going to start talking about the skeletal system right now, and we see a picture of the skeletal system right here. So you got to know what are the components of the skeletal system, and of course bones, that would be everybody's first guess. So bones in your body are part of your skeletal system, but it has some other components as well, and that is cartilage. Any kind of cartilage in your body is part of your skeletal system. And what can you tell me about cartilage? You already have a pretty good education with cartilage. What can you tell me about it? You got three kinds, right? In order of strength, you got hyaline cartilage, elastic cartilage, fibrocartilage, and now we're going to see where this is employed in your body a little bit. And then there's another component as well, which we haven't talked much about yet, and that is a ligament. So bones, cartilage, and ligaments are all part of the skeletal system. And a ligament is just a bone-to-bone connection, and the kind of tissue that it is dense, regular connective tissue, is what a ligament is. So a ligament and a tendon are very, very similar, except the tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection, but still it's dense, regular connective tissue. So you know a lot about this stuff already. In lab, we don't talk much about functions, just a little bit. So we got to spend some time talking about functions of the skeletal system. Some things are pretty obvious, right? Support is one of the obvious things. Bones support your weight, right? So you have a number of vertebrae in your vertebral column. The ones that are superior aren't holding up a whole lot of weight, so they're kind of small. But the ones that are inferior down by your pelvic cavity are holding up your whole body. So those have to be, what, bigger and stronger as a result. So bone is important because it can bear great weight. It can hold your body up as well as other long bones in your body. All right, so bone is rigid and strong. Cartilage, on the other hand, is firm, but it's a little bit flexible, so it can be used in some regions of your body that are more bendy or can deform, for instance, like the rib cage. Nasal cavity is partly made up of cartilage. Right, your ear has elastic cartilage in it, so it can deform and then bounce back to its original shape. And also, we didn't talk about this in lab, cartilage can also act as a precursor to bone. So in development or in utero during gestation, bones are modeled where they're going to be out of cartilage first, right? And then as time progresses, that cartilage then turns into bone. We call that process ossification. So cartilage can be used for all of those different things. Another nice thing about cartilage is that it can make a structure, like for instance the tip of your nose, and cartilage is very light. So if we were to take all the cartilage in your body and convert it into bone, you would need a whole lot more energy to haul all that extra weight around all day long. All right, so cartilage is also is lightweight, so it's easier to maintain and easier to carry around with you. All right, another important function of bone is protection. So bone can act like armor plating. The armor plating around your brain is called the skull. They're cranial bones, so that just protects your brain from puncture wounds, right, and from compression. The rib cage is also important for protection. What the heck is it protecting? What is your rib cage protecting? Like, yeah, lungs would be a really important thing. Lungs are extremely delicate tissue. And so the rib cage helps protect your lungs, but also help the function of the lungs expand and contract, kind of like a bellows. All right, but what's another important organ in your thoracic cage that your thoracic cage protects? Your heart, exactly. So lungs and heart are protected by the thoracic cage, as well as the great vessels that come off the top of the heart. We call that the base of the heart. There are a number of huge blood vessels that connect to the heart, and those are protected by the rib cage. And, of course, the vertebral column made up of vertebrae protects what? It's armor plating that surrounds the spinal cord, right? And all nervous tissue is pretty delicate. The brain is really delicate. That's why there are cranial bones. Spinal cord is delicate, and it's almost completely surrounded by the vertebral column. All right, so that's for protection. Skeletal system is also important for movement because skeletal muscles, and they're named because they attach to your skeleton, right, attach to bones, and a skeletal muscle is specialized to do what kind of thing? What does skeletal muscle specialize to do? When it's stimulated, what does it do? It contracts. It shortens, right? So if you have a skeletal muscle connecting two bones, when a skeletal muscle is stimulated, then those two bones move closer together. And the arrangement of those different bones then allows for different kinds of motion or movement of your skeletal system. So movement is very important. And bones are connected to each other via joints. And another really fancy name for joint is, and I'll use this interchangeably, is an articulation. Articulation is the same thing as a joint. They have special, they're different kind of joints that we're going to look at in a couple chapters. Ligaments are bone-to-bone connections that actually prevent or limit the movement between certain bones. So some bones have freely movable joints, like your elbow, that's a freely movable joint. It moves back and forth, flexes and extends. But you have some other joints in your body that should be immovable. Where are some bones in your body that should not move with respect to each other? We've had some discussions of these joints already in lab. Maybe you can remember where... Okay, I like that. Cranial bones of the head. Those bones shouldn't be moving. The only time I really see moving is in like a science fiction movie when telepaths are communicating to each other without speaking. Sometimes their cranium wiggles back and forth. But normally that does not happen, right? Okay, so there are ligaments then that connect these bones together. All right, bones are also important storage place for some elements like calcium ions. So you need calcium to have strong bones, but you need calcium in other areas of your body. And we're going to talk about those, and some of these different areas of your body might even be more important than bones. All right, so bone is a storage place for calcium. So if when you run low on calcium in your body, guess where blood gets calcium from when you start to run low on calcium? It gets it from bones. That's right. So bones will be sacrificed. Right, they'll dissolve away to release calcium into your body when it's needed. So, of course, you don't want that to happen because you know that's a disease process when your bones get brittle because they lack calcium. Anybody know that disease process, what it's called? It's called osteoporosis, and that's not good because when bones get brittle, then they break, right? They fracture very easily. So you want to have good calcium in your diet. And then there's a vitamin that you need to absorb that calcium from your diet. So even though you have proper calcium in your diet, it doesn't get into your body unless you have a vitamin to go along with it, which also has to be part of your diet, which is vitamin D, right? So proper levels of calcium in your diet, vitamin D, in order to absorb it, and then for it to be incorporated into bone, what do you got to do with those bones? You can't just let a bone sit out on a table and because it will actually dissolve away if that happens. Just like if you don't use a muscle, it will atrophy, it will go away. Bones need to be exercised as well to stay strong. So to protect yourself from osteoporosis, you need good dietary intake of calcium, you need good dietary intake of vitamin D, and here's the worst part, you have to exercise, right? So to stay healthy, basically there are two things that you need to do is always what? Diet and exercise. Properly. All right, there's another element that's also necessary to keep bones strong, and that is phosphate. Phosphate incorporated with some oxygen elements is what we call inorganic phosphate. Sometimes we just label that PI, standing for inorganic phosphate, because it's just not the element phosphate, but there's some oxygen associated with it. So this is what bone is really made up of. The matrix of bone has calcium and phosphate together. To make bones strong. And then bones also have cavities. And in those cavities, we can store fat. So there's adipose tissue in, for instance, like the medullary cavity of long bones. And fat is just a nice storage form of energy. All right, so even if you have spaces inside those bones, it's not wasted, it's put to good use. And another good use for the space in the inside of a bone, that space is what we call a cavity, and it can be filled with marrow, right? The first kind that we talked about, adipose tissue, is what we call yellow marrow, but there's another kind of marrow that fills cavities inside bones, and that is red bone marrow. Red bone marrow is not a storage area for energy, right? It's a place where red blood cells are made. So the medullary cavities inside bones can be used to store fat, or it can be used to make red blood cells. And is that an important function? The production of red blood cells. Yeah, how many red blood cells do you have to make? 2 million when? Every day? Every month? Every year? Every second? I know it's freaky. You have to stop and think. You need to make so many millions of red blood cells every second or you become anemic. So bone is an important hematopoietic tissue. It's a kind of tissue that makes what? Blood cells, in particular red blood cells and platelets. So a hematopoietic tissue is a tissue that makes red blood cells for you. That's important to know. So bones have all of these important functions. Okay. All right, so on the figure right here, we see bones, but we also see the location of some different types of cartilage. And you know the various kinds of cartilage. All right, so hyaline cartilage. What can you tell me about hyaline cartilage? What is it lacking? It has a nice matrix, but something in the there's something that you find in other kinds of cartilages that you don't find in hyaline cartilage. You don't find fibers. You don't find elastic fibers. You don't find collagen fibers. So hyaline cartilage is very compressible. It's very sponge-like, but it means it's not very strong. But it's kind of slippery because it contains a lot of water. So hyaline cartilage you see in, I guess that's a blue. Is that a blue color? Yeah, fantastic. I'm getting better. Blue, right here. That's hyaline cartilage. So it makes the rib cage. It makes some cartilages in the nose, but even more importantly, it covers the epiphyses of bones. Those are the tips of bones that articulate with other bones. So when you have a movable joint, the bones that come together at a movable joint don't touch each other, right? What touches the ends of these bones together is hyaline cartilage, which is smooth and slippery. So that means these bones can move very nicely without grinding each other down. That's a pathological condition. What do you call it when your bones actually touch each other in a movable joint and grind each other away? Yeah, that's arthritis. Very painful condition. Right? And then there's a couple different kinds of arthritis. One used to be always fatal. Right? Now there's some pretty good treatment to stop the progression. Okay? And anybody know the name of that one? I'm blocking what the name is. It's not osteoarthritis. It's rheumatoid arthritis, okay? Okay, and that's just degeneration of the joint because the hyaline cartilage goes away. Elastic cartilage, for instance, in the ear, that's a good place, right? We can deform the ear and then you let that tension go, release the tension, the ear goes back to its normal location. And then there's fibrocartilage, which is, in terms of strength, what kind? You got three kinds in terms of strength. You got delicate, weak, then you got moderately strong but stretchy, and then you got really strong, which is fibrocartilage because it has collagen, right? So collagen fibers are really strong. So some important locations where you have fibrocartilage are in the knee. There's something called a meniscus that's made out of fibrocartilage. There are intervertebral discs between the vertebral bodies that are fibrocartilage, okay, and a couple of other locations. In the TMJ, what's the TMJ? Temporomandibular joint. There's something like a knee meniscus in this joint right here that helps the functioning of the temporomandibular joint. I think we talked about that. And as well, here's a joint between the pubic bones of a pelvis, right? We call that the pubic symphysis. It's made out of fibrocartilage, and that's a pretty stiff joint under most circumstances. But unfortunately, if you go through the handlebars of your motorcycle, right, that will separate, and if it heals, it mostly goes back to where it was, which is a really nice thing. But there's another condition where there's a separation of the pubic symphysis, and that is during parturition. Right, so that joint dissolves away so that the pelvic bones can separate a little bit. That allows for delivery a little bit easier. Right, and then after parturition, the bones go back together, and the pubic symphysis goes back to where it was, mostly, not exactly. Okay. All right, so those are the three kinds of cartilage. Hyaline, we say glass-like because it doesn't have fibers in it. And of course, you should know the cell type that we find in cartilage are what we call chondrocytes. All right, and what class of tissue is this? Of the four main classes of tissues, it's a connective tissue, right? Which means that it has an extensive matrix. And so within the matrix of this glass-like material, there's a soluble collagen, so you can't see it as a fiber. Okay, elastic cartilage is similar to hyaline cartilage, but it contains elastic fibers. Oh, and where are these, and it has chondrocytes. Where are these chondrocytes located? Within lacunae, right? So here we see three different kinds of cartilage by histological section. Here's a lacunae with a chondrocyte in there. I don't see any fibers, so that's got to be nice hyaline cartilage. And then here is elastic cartilage because I see a nice branching pattern. Here's another lacunae with a chondrocyte in there. And then lastly, the strongest kind of cartilage, like what we find in a knee meniscus, is fibrocartilage. Here's a lacunae with a chondrocyte. And now I can see very thick collagen fibers within the matrix. Right? So these are pretty easily observable. Oh, here's another important place for elastic cartilage. Here's a spot that is pretty bendy, a cartilage that's very bending. It's called the epiglottis. The epiglottis is a piece of cartilage, okay, that can separate your esophagus, which is the tube that takes food from your oral cavity to your stomach, okay, and it can separate material that's going through the esophagus from other material that are going into your windpipe. So it's a trapdoor that closes the windpipe off or your trachea, okay, every time you do what? Every time you swallow something, right? And then when you breathe, then the epiglottis bends back to its original location. So should you ever try to breathe and swallow at the same time? Because if you're breathing, the epiglottis is open, and it might stay open when you accidentally swallow something, and where could food go? Instead of down the esophagus, it could go into your windpipe, and then it might get stuck, and then your windpipe's occluded. What do we call that when your windpipe or trachea is occluded? We call that choking, right? And choking is never fun because you can't breathe. You have a few seconds of consciousness. If you are choking, what should you do so that you can call for help? If you're choking, you usually can't use your vocal cords, but so you need some sign language. What's a sign language that says, help, I need to start breathing again? Because you might not be turning purple just yet, okay? Yeah, put your hands over your throat like this, okay? So that's kind of the universal sign for choking, and if anybody's CPR certified, they know some techniques to help you start breathing. Like, what's that called? Anybody know what that's called? That's called a Heimlich maneuver, okay? That's kind of a radical maneuver. You don't want to do it on somebody that's not choking. So if you think somebody is choking but they're not, they don't go like this. All right, before you do the Heimlich maneuver, which you do from behind somebody and you ram their intestines and diaphragm up into their lungs and that expels that material, what should you do before you do that to somebody that's not asking for help? You should ask them, are they choking, right? Otherwise, there's possibility that you could end up talking to a lawyer and a jury and a judge and all that kind of stuff. So just ask them, and if they cannot respond, then that's a pretty good sign that most juries would perceive as to what, that they're asking for help, that they are choking. Okay, the fibrocartilage that we see in intervertebral discs has an outside part, we call that the annulus fibrosus, okay, and then there's a jelly-like material on the inside. So if the annulus fibrosus is damaged, then that jelly-like material can break away from the interior of a disc and squirt out, and it can actually then squirt into the intervertebral foramen between vertebrae and impinge upon a nerve that's leaving, and that's why it causes pain or motion deficits in people if you damage an intervertebral disc. Okay, so those are, oh, look at those really pretty pictures of various kinds of cartilage. Okay, types of bones. We do classify bones by their shape. All right, so here we see the humerus, which is in our arm, and it's not very wide, okay, from right to left. And if you go from anterior to posterior, it's not very deep, but if you measure it from superior to inferior, it's a very long dimension. So that's the typical designation for a long bone. A long bone is a bone where at least one dimension is extreme compared to the remaining two dimensions, right? And even these bones in the tips of your fingers are really, really short. They're really tiny, but they're still long bones because one dimension is big compared to the other two, all right? So that's typically what we call a long bone. A flat bone is flat, like for instance the sternum right here and the manubrium. All right, then there's some short bones that we find in some joints like the wrist and the ankle. no matter how you measure this bone, it has about the same dimension, almost as kind of square, but not quite. All right? And then there are some bones that have a very strange shape, like this vertebrae. I wouldn't even know how to measure the length or the width of this bone, because depending on where you look, right, like in the spinous process right here, it's very thin, but then the vertebral body is really thick, right, from right to left, and then the transverse processes again, when you measure from right to left, is a very long dimension. So we just call these irregular shaped bones. So make sure you have an example of these different bones. What's not shown explicitly on this slide right here is another kind of bone, and that is called a sesamoid bone. A sesamoid bone might articulate with muscles and some other bones, but it's a bone that's completely found within a tendon or a ligament. All right, so here an example of that would be the patella or your kneecap. So there is a tendon that comes from muscles in your anterior thigh that go down to your leg that cause you to kick, right? And that bone is completely surrounded by a tendon, so it's a sesamoid bone. You have just very few sesamoid bones in your body. Sometimes they can develop under abnormal conditions. Maybe if you're a dental hygienist and you're using your hands and fingers all day long, or maybe a mechanic that's working on engines or something, using a lot of strength to put engines together, you might get bones developing within tendons of your fingers. All right? And sometimes that's a kind of a severe irritation, and that would be called a sesamoid bone. So some sesamoid bones are very normal, that make a joint function properly, like the patella. Other sesamoid bones are irritations, and then you have to figure out what you want to do with those. You got to talk to somebody that knows something about that. Okay, so if you have a sesamoid bone in a tendon that's causing an irritation, you might think, well, let's just have some surgery and pull it out. But what happens when you do surgery? You irritate that area as well, right? And you cause other kinds of fibrosis in that area, so that might not be the best solution for you. Okay, so those are the types of bones that you should be aware of. Let's look at a long bone, like maybe a humerus right here, or a femur that we have in the thigh, and analyze it. Let's dissect that bone so that we can understand, we'll use that understanding of a long bone and apply it to all of these other shapes of bones, because they're going to be very, very similar. All right, so where is a nice, here's an example of a long bone. For instance, that's the humerus. All right, so let's cut that humerus open, and it's going to look something like this. All right, so when we looked at bone underneath a microscope, we saw all of these lamella, all of these little ring structures, kind of look like tree rings. All right, and we said that this kind of bone is very strong. It doesn't compress if you push it from top to bottom like this, because these are tubes. Tubes inside tubes. And tubular structures are very strong. They resist compression. Right? And not only is a bone, a long bone, tubes with inside tubes, but what's next to these tubes inside tubes? More tubes inside tubes, right? So they're all surrounding each other. And then if you look at the superficial part of a long bone, there are even tubes that surround all of those tubes. So bones are very, very strong. So this is an example of what we call compact bone. It's solid. It's made of all these lamellated structures that we call osteon. So here is an osteon. In the very center of an osteon, we see a Haversian canal with blood vessels. Right. So here I see a blood vessel in that central canal or Haversian canal. Okay, so we call that compact bone, but it's also on the superficial part of the bone right here. So sometimes we call that cortical bone. Compact bone and cortical bone are the same, because the superficial part of any organ is called the cortex. The deep part of any organ is called the medulla. So here is a cavity, and I see some yellow bone marrow, which is what kind of tissue? Adipose connective tissue. And we call this the medullary cavity, because the medulla of the bone is the deep part of the bone. And this compact bone sometimes we call cortical bone, because it's what? It's on the outside of the bone. So this is the cortical region of the organ. Here is the medullary part of the organ. Now I'm calling bone an organ. Why am I calling bone an organ? An organ is a living tissue, and you agree that this is a living tissue. What's the structural and functional unit of life called? It's the cell. So bone has to have cells. Do you agree that bone has cells? Yeah, because you know the name of these cells that live within the lacunae, right inside these lamella right here. What are the cells that live in bone? Osteocytes, right. And these osteocytes maintain the health of the bone, and they're remodeling bone all the time. They're making it stronger or weaker depending on your activity level. So every 5 years, you have a completely new skeletal system. So it's not like this concrete pillar in the building that's been there since 1910 or whenever we built the building. Not quite that long. Okay. We don't have to come around every 5 years and replace that pillar because that's not a living structure. But your skeletal system responds to what kind of stresses that you apply to it. So if you don't use a bone, guess what happens? It gets more brittle and weaker, which is why the way you protect yourself from osteoporosis is to exercise, right? When you stress a bone, just like if you were to stress this muscle, it would get bigger and stronger over time, which is what you want to have happen. Okay, on the outside of bone, even a long bone, you have a membrane, right? And it's going to be named after the root of the word that says bone. What's the root word that means bone? Osteo. So this right here, since it's on the outside, we call it the periosteum. It's a membrane that surrounds the bone. There's also a membrane that lines every internal cavity and space inside the bone. We call that the endosteum. So peri means on the outside. Endo means on the inside. And the other thing I notice on the inside of the bone, this medullary bone right here is not compact, but it has all these little bony plates and ridges to it. All right, and it reminds me of a sponge, and it reminded somebody else of a sponge, and so they named it spongy bone. Spongy bone also goes by a couple other names. Since it's deep inside the bone, sometimes it's called medullary bone, and it looks a lot different than cortical bone. And because these bony plates are called trabeculae, sometimes it's called trabecular bone, sometimes it's called cancellous bone. So those are all the same terms for this type of bone that looks spongy. So spongy, medullary, trabecular, cancellous bone are all the same kind of thing. Usually we don't use all of those terms in the same sentence, but somebody might, okay? I don't know who would. Usually you pick one and kind of stick with it, okay? There are some fibers, connective tissue fibers, that connect the periosteum to cortical bone over here, and you could guess what kind of fiber is that. If you were going to design a body, what kind of fiber would you use? A stretchy kind? A really weak kind, or a pretty strong one? Yeah, a strong one. Which one is that? Collagen. Yeah, so there are collagen fibers, right, that connect the periosteum to cortical bone, and those are what we call perforating fibers or Sharpie's fibers. And then every once in a while, we have a nutrient foramen right here. That's a hole near the diaphysis of a bone that allows a blood vessel to enter, veins to leave. And remember, since bone is a living tissue, it is highly vascular. And that's one of the dangerous things. Whenever you fracture a bone, of course, you rip these blood vessels. So hemorrhage is definitely a serious condition. Somebody can bleed to death, hemorrhage to death when they break a big bone, right? You have to be concerned with a little bit. But it has an upside. There's a trade-off for bone having a nice vascular supply. And that is, once it's damaged, how does it heal? Very nicely and rapidly, right? Within 5 to 6 weeks, a bone can be rebuilt because it has living cells in there that are going to rebuild the bone. It has nice oxygen and nutrient supply so that it can be rebuilt relatively rapidly, as long as you don't break it again in the process, all right? And how do we protect bones so they don't break again before they're healed? Yeah, most bones are casted, right, so that they don't break. Because that broken part is called a callus, and there's some cartilage, there's some collagen fibers, but there's not enough collagen fibers to really stabilize that bone in that location, and it can be broken again pretty easily before it's healed. But once it's healed, a broken bone in that area is probably even stronger than it was before, okay, if you let it heal properly. All right, so those are some features of a long bone. Let's talk about some more features. I got to get control of my cursor here. Come on over here. Okay, so here's what we were looking at previously, which is just this section of a long bone, but now I see the complete long bone. The tips of a long bone are what we call the epiphyses, right? And one's going to be proximal end, the other's going to be the distal end. So the proximal end is the end of a long bone that's closest to some a center location point of your body or attachment point to your axial skeleton. So here we see the proximal epiphysis. There's the distal epiphysis. Probably a good idea for you to practice saying that word out loud, epiphysis. That will help you with the spelling. Sometimes it looks really obvious on the slide, but maybe sometime it will escape you how to spell it. But if you can say it out loud, then that will really help you say it. And it's not, it's pronounced with kind of a swing to it, so it really helps to say it out loud. Epiphysis. And then the shaft of a long bone is what we call the diaphysis. Right? Notice the spelling of diaphysis. And then here's that medullary cavity that's filled with bone marrow. Okay, so here's some spongy bone that really is observable in the epiphyses of the bone. And then I see a line moving through the parts of the cancellous or trabecular bone, the medullary bone, the long bone. And this sometimes is called the growth plate. And our long bones don't grow in length through our whole lifespan, but up until puberty, right, our long bones are growing from epiphysis to epiphysis. And this is the region in which it grows from. It's called the epiphyseal plate. And the epiphyseal plate is made out of cartilage. And what is a stronger tissue? Which one can resist compression more? Bone or cartilage, do you think? Which is a stronger tissue? Bone can resist compression very, very nicely, all right? But cartilage can't. So in somebody who is still growing, right, in tallness, this epiphyseal plate is kind of vulnerable to compression, but also to twisting. So I know youngsters are protected from hurting these epiphyseal plates because if they are damaged, then that means that this bone is going to stop growing. All right, so little kids that are in baseball, like Little League, especially pitchers, right, they're taught to only throw certain kinds of pitches that don't twist the bone, especially the humerus and bones that make up the forearm, because whenever they throw a pitch like a curveball or a screwball, which means they have to rotate and twist their arm pretty dramatically, it can damage these epiphyseal plates right here, which would be terrible because that's what your dominant arm that you pitch with. So that arm won't develop normally. So when you're in Little League, you can only throw really fast pitches, which are just straight on pitches with no twisting of the arm, just really fast, okay, just and straight. Okay, or another way that typically people damage this epiphyseal plate, for instance, especially during development before you reach puberty, is we've all done this, so I'm sure one of our legs is shorter than the other a little bit. We used to go on a swing and swing really, really high, right? And then you kind of fall back down, which is fun. And then when you get tired of that, what's even more fun? Yeah, get really, really high and then let go of the swing and go flying through the air, and flying is an amazing feeling, right? But what's the downside? Landing. You always have to land, right? And landing is compression of this nice bone in the axial direction, which can damage these epiphyseal plates. And if you damage one leg and not the other, then you're going to have one leg that's what? Shorter compared to the other. And then to balance your walking gait out, then you need a lift in one shoe to do that. So youngsters do need to be given a little bit of guidance. But I know how some of you are, okay, or were. Like when your mom tells you not to do something, what would you do? Do it even more, right? I was never like that. Okay. So anyway, that's that epiphyseal plate. What's another name for epiphyseal plate? It could be called the growth plate, right? Because that's how bone grows in length. All right, so that's the typical long bone with the epiphyses, the diaphysis, spongy bone, compact bone or cortical bone, medullary cavity. What are the two kinds of things that you can have placed in medullary cavity? Two kinds of marrow. Yellow or red, right? Not usually both at the same time. Okay. We want to zoom into this region. Maybe the next slide over here will show us something of that. Pretty good. All right, so these structures, these lamellated structures right here, we call those osteons. I don't have a good picture of an osteon. That's as good as we have these days. All right, so here is an osteon. No, let me look. Let me look in here. Oh, here's even a better picture. Okay. All right, so here is just a cross-section of some bone that's superficial. What do we call superficial bone on a bone? Could be called compact, could be called cortical bone. So here is a zoomed-in region of some cortical bone or compact bone. These different circles right here are really tubes that you see extending out. So those are lamellae. And these are called concentric lamellae. Might not be labeled on this diagram. Concentric lamellae. And if we put a number of concentric lamellae together with this central canal, sometimes that central canal is called a haversian canal. This structure right here is what gives bone a lot of strength. We call it an osteon. So it's like the structural and functional unit of compact bone. What's the structural and functional unit of life? Cell, right? So I'll use that kind of as a theme in the class. And if you understand how an osteon is put together, then you know why compact bone is so strong. So let's look at some other features. Okay, on the inside you have a nerve and some blood vessels, both an artery and a vein. You have these lamella, which are the inner rings, right? And then you have some collagen fibers that wrap around the lamellae. And between the lamellae you have lacunae, which are not shown on this slide. Okay, but a lacunae has an osteocyte on the inside. Right? And between the lacunae you can see some of these little bridges. Right? And those little bridges we call canaliculi. So material, since these lamellae are made out of calcium and phosphate, which is as solid as this tabletop, maybe even stronger, material can't move across this lamellae right here from these blood vessels. So these cells would starve to death. Right? They wouldn't get oxygen. So material moves from one lacunae to another through these little, like almost like cracks, but they're special passageways so that oxygen can move to these cells. These cells then produce CO2. The CO2 can move back to these blood vessels, and you can excrete it from your body. All right, so canaliculi are a way for movement of material, like those gases, as well as water and nutrients, to make sure that these osteocytes stay alive. All right, so these are concentric lamellae, and then in the very superficial part of the bone, you can see the circumferential lamellae. All right, so indeed, you have all these tubes inside tubes, and surrounding all the tubes are even more tubes, which then almost completely prevents compression of this bone. So here is the blood vessels in the central canal, but we also have blood vessels that move kind of in a transverse plane between the central canals, and these are what we call perforating canals or Wolfman's canals to move nutrients, right, and waste products laterally within the bone structure as well. All right, so central canal versus the perforating canals or Wolfman's canals. And here you see the nice periosteum with the perforating or Sharpie's fibers. And then what kind of membrane do you see lining all of these little trabeculae right here? Not shown very well. Maybe I see a little bit of it here. What's the membrane on the inside of a bone called? That's the endosteum, right? Okay, and don't forget, inside these little lacunae right here are the osteocytes. Oh, here's even a better picture. All right, so we zoomed into a little quarter of an osteon. Here is a lacunae with an osteocyte. There you can see the nucleus. And then these tiny little passageways, they're not fractures in the bone, they belong there. Those are the canaliculi that allow for movement of nutrients and waste products, right, from the haversian arteries to these various layers within an osteon. Okay. So that's it for a typical kind of long bone. All right, let's talk about the chemical composition of bones. So a bone has organic components. Those include some living materials and some inorganic components. Right? And an inorganic component, well, in order to be an organic component, it has to have a carbon atom. If it has no carbon atom, right, then we're going to call that an inorganic compound. So you know the name of an inorganic compound already that's in bone, because it doesn't contain carbon atoms, and that is calcium, right? Calcium doesn't contain carbon, that's just an element. So within the matrix of this bone tissue, there is calcium, and there's also some phosphate. Right? So that makes up some of the inorganic component of bone. But there's also living tissue, these cells, right, which is part of the organic component of bone. And then there's also fibers that are made out of collagen. And collagen is an organic component of bone. So let's talk about these different components. All right, so an organic component, one would be a cell. There is an osteoprogenitor cell, all right, that actually makes a model of what this bone should look like during development. And some of these progenitor cells are located in the periosteum, which I don't see on this diagram right here, but the periosteum surrounds the bone on the outside, and even in the endosteum that I can see right here, right? And these progenitor cells can replace these cells that maybe die, or as the bone grows, you need to have more osteocytes develop. So these are the cells that make all of the cells that we find in bone. So of the osteocytes that we have in bone, there are a couple different classes. Right? An osteocyte is the cell that we see in mature bone. That's not growing very rapidly. There is another kind that can build bone very rapidly, and that's called an osteoblast. So an osteoblast builds up bone for when it's growing. It deposits new matrix between the cells. So an osteoblast is a kind of cell that we see in growing bone. All right, and then the last kind is what we call an osteoclast. An osteoclast is a kind of cell that actually dissolves the matrix of bone. It dissolves bone away. So, for instance, when a bone is growing, it's solid, completely solid. Let me go back to a picture of bone in this direction here. Right here. All right, so when a bone is really, really small, it is completely solid bone. Okay, and then as it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, this medullary cavity develops. It gets hollowed out on the inside of compact bone. All right, so the cells that are in the endosteum that make this cavity are called what? Osteoclasts. Because that this cavity inside a solid bone has to be like dug out. The cells that do that are the osteoclasts that dissolve the calcium and phosphate out. The way that a bone grows in diameter is that there are cells in the periosteum here that deposit new bone on the outside, on the superficial surface of the bone. What are the names of cells that actually deposit matrix on the surface of a bone? Okay, let's start, we'll get back to that question in a second. What are the names of the cells that live in mature bone, like an osteon? That's an osteocyte. The cells that break bone down on the inside of the bone that live in the endosteum are called osteoclasts. And the names of the bone cells that live in the periosteum that make the bone thicker on the outside are what we call osteoblasts. So blasts build bone, clasts break it down, and plain old osteocytes live in bone that isn't being remodeled at that particular time. So we got these cells. That's an organic part of bone. The other organic part of bone is collagen. All right, and let's look at a picture of collagen fibers within bone. Okay, so here are a number of lamellae, and within this lamellae, okay, I see a lot of collagen fibers. And these collagen fibers have a really interesting kind of arrangement. In the superficial lamellae, notice they move, as you go from inferior to superior, they move to the right. And as you get to the next layer, which way do they move? The opposite way, almost perpendicular to each other. Right, and when you get into the next layer, look at the arrangement of the fibers. It moves perpendicular once again. So these collagen fibers don't run straight up and down within bone, but they intersect each other almost at right angles, right from layer to layer. And some people might be really familiar with that kind of arrangement. It's a way to increase the strength of material. For instance, when you buy plywood, right? Plywood has a grain, and it's made out of a number of different layers. So if you want to make plywood really strong, how should you align the layers? With them all parallel to each other? Actually what? More perpendicular, so that it resists bending and stretching between the layers. And then the next layer again is perpendicular. You have belts inside the tires of your car, okay, with different layers. then they might contain steel cables. They'll find steel cables in here. And in order to make a tire strong, what about the arrangement of those steel cables or little steel fibers in your tire? They should be arranged, what, perpendicular to each other once again, and that gives added strength to the wall and the tread pattern of the tire as a result. So this is an inorganic, no, this is an organic part of bone as well, the collagen. And where do we find that collagen? Where do you find collagen in a connective tissue? In the matrix, right? So it's extracellular, it's in the matrix of bone, right? So this kind of fiber is important because collagen, remember, can't stretch. So collagen, that organic part of bone, prevents bones from stretching. And it prevents bone from twisting. So collagen prevents what we call torsion, which is twisting. And it prevents stretching, which we call tension. So the organic part of the matrix resists tension and torsion forces of bone. All right, let's talk about the inorganic part of bone. The inorganic part of bone contains mineral salts that we call hydroxyapatites, and hydroxyapatites are part calcium and part inorganic phosphate. They're put together in these combinations right here. It's not important that you know these different combinations, but it's probably important that you know that the matrix has both calcium and phosphate that comes together, and hydroxyapatite can resist a certain kind of stress on a bone that we call compression. So if we were to take a bone and try to crush it, that's what we call compression. So the inorganic part of bone prevents compressing, like from the epiphyses down or even from side to side. But what are some other stresses that can damage a bone? Stretching and twisting. And calcium and phosphate do very little to resist stretching or twisting. Okay, as a matter of fact, even concrete does a really poor job of resisting twisting and stretching. If you take that concrete pillar right there and you stretch it, it's going to crumble. Okay, that concrete pillar is really good to withstand compression, right? But during an earthquake, what's going to happen to that pillar right there? It's going to twist and it's going to stretch, and that's when concrete fails. So on freeways, all freeways now have been retrofitted. What have been done to freeway pillars that hold up bridges that are just made out of concrete? They put a metal sleeve around them, and whenever a pillar is made, rebar is put inside that concrete pillar so that the rebar prevents the twisting and stretching, and the concrete itself resists compression. So now it's strong for all different kinds of modes of deformation. And our bones have evolved just in that same sense. It has like these steel cables, which are what? What are the little steel cables in bone? Collagen, okay, which resists stretching and twisting. And what part of bone resists compression? That's the calcium and phosphate. So bones are pretty strong, right? It can resist tension, can resist torsion, and compression, right? Because through evolution, it's been designed to do that. All right, so the organic and inorganic mixture come together to make bones very durable and strong, right, without becoming brittle. If they were made just out of calcium and phosphate, they would be brittle, but the organic parts make it really strong. All right, so what components of bone resist torsion? What's another way of thinking about torsion? Twisting. What resists twisting? I see it on this slide right here. The collagen fibers. All right, which resists compression? The hydroxyapatite, the calcium and phosphate, resist compression, so bones don't compress. And what about tension? What's tension? Stretching. That would be the collagen, because that's typically the job of collagen, is to resist stretching, right? Just from histology. You should remember that. Okay, microscopic structure of bones. We talked about the concentric lamellae. Okay, versus the circumferential lamellae. Where are the circumferential lamellae located? We did have a picture. I think it was right here. They're right on the superficial surface. All right, so these completely go all the way around the bone. That's a huge tube. It has a big diameter. All right, the concentric lamellae are the small little tubes that make up an osteon. So here are the concentric lamellae, here are the circumferential lamellae. canaliculi are the little canals between the lacunae. What does the lacunae contain? Osteocyte, right? And then you have different canals, either perforating canals or haversian canals that supply blood to the haversian system. And what is the structural and functional unit of compact bone called? I see it right here. That is called? If you were going to put a bracket right here, what would you label this bracket? Not just the, not the bracket right in here for the central canal, but a bracket that shows all of these concentric lamellae. Yeah, that's the osteon. I see it right here. Right? So osteon, so you should know something about the osteon. If you know an osteon, then you really know everything about compact bone, because that's the structural and functional unit for compact bone. Okay, bone formation and growth. There are two kinds of ways that bones grow. Okay, and one is called intramembranous ossification, and the other is endochondrial ossification. All right, so a membrane is just a flat sheet of connective tissue, and it might have some epithelium. All right, but like fontanelles within the skull are a membrane. Sometimes membranes become bones. That process we call ossification. So there are some bones that actually evolve or develop from membranes, right? So we call that intramembranous. So most bones of the skull at one time were membranes, and then they turn into bone over time. So that would be intramembranous ossification. So within that membrane, there are osteoblasts. What's the job of an osteoblast? To build bone, right? So there are osteoblasts within a membrane in a fetal skull that then lay down bone matrix, which is hydroxyapatite and those collagen fibers. And then that membrane slowly turns into bone, which is really, really hard. Okay. And then after the bone is made, those osteoblasts become osteocytes, right? After they're completely surrounded by bone, and those osteocytes then can be found in those lacunae, those little bubbles within the bone matrix. Okay, so at birth, bones are not completely formed in the skull. Right, in the head, the non-ossified portions are called fontanelles or soft spots. We look at those in lab. And fontanelles have a couple reasons for existing in a fetus and even a newborn. And that's because in order to be born through parturition, you have to move through the birth canal. And the skull, the fetal skull, is way too big to fit through the birth canal. So it has to stretch out and elongate during the parturition process, right? And those fontanelles allow for a lot of motion between the bones of the skull, and it prevents fracturing those bones. Okay. And the other reason is that the brain grows very rapidly after birth. It grows a lot faster than the bone. So the brain would outpace the growth of the bones that make up the cranium. So that would mean that the brain would try to grow, but the cranium would constrict the growth of the brain, and there would be severe neurological deficits in that developing individual. All right, so those fontanelles allow for stretching of the cranium during the first couple of years of life, because that's when the brain is like exploding in growth. It's growing very, very rapidly. So surprisingly, the fontanelles last for up to 2 years, right, postpartum, which is a really long time. Before I learned that, I kind of knew of fontanelles, because everybody, when you pick up a newborn infant, what do they tell you when you're just a little kid? Oh, be careful. Support their head, right? Don't do anything to hurt the infant. So I thought, well, okay. I thought fontanelles might last for 6 months, maybe a year on the outside. That's a really long time. But look what it is. It's really 2 years. So you have to protect, right, a neonate for a long time, not just from puncture wounds, but from vibration and twisting and compression, any of those kinds of forces, right? Their cranium can't protect their brain from. All right, so that's intramembranous ossification. The only other bone in the rest of your body that develops from intramembranous ossification, we haven't studied it yet, okay, are the clavicles, right? Your clavicle is kind of like a long bone. It's not in your skull, but that is, oh, what's that commonly called? Your clavicle right here. Collarbone, yeah, collarbone, thank you, collarbone. That is also develops from intramembranous ossification. All the rest of the bones in your body develop from endochondrial ossification. Ossification just means forming solid bone matrix. And what can you tell me about endochondrial? What does that word mean to you? It has something to do with cartilage, right? Chondrial, a chondrocyte is a cartilage cell. And endo means on the inside, right? So this just means that in most parts of the body, the bone is made out of a cartilage model first, so it's completely cartilage, hyaline cartilage in particular, and then from the inside, it ossifies, it turns into bone. That's what this process means. Okay, so a model of the bone is made out of hyaline cartilage during development, and I suppose that's kind of handy for parturition as well, right, because all the other bones in your body can kind of squish and get out through the birth canal. All right, but the cartilage model is ossified in stages. I want you to know something about these stages, right, which involves a primary ossification center and a secondary ossification center. So let's look at some of these things. So here is a bone. And what kind of bone is this going to be eventually? It's going to be irregular or short, or it's all going to be a long bone, right? Because the width is about equal to the depth, but the height of this bone is really long, right? So it's a nice long bone. All right, so here is a model of cartilage, all right? And then in the very center, right, there are some osteoblasts that start to deposit bone within the center of this cartilage model. So here's a hyaline cartilage model. And then also on the outside, right, so there's endochondrial membrane on the outside that has osteoblasts, so it starts to develop a bone on the outside. This forms a ring around the bone on the outside and then a little nucleus on the inside where bone starts to develop. This ring is what we call a collar, a bone collar. This is the primary ossification center that begins. So the bone starts to develop, and then there are osteoclasts in the endosteum that start to dissolve, that start to dissolve some of the bone away on the inside, so it's not just solid bone, so the medullary cavity starts to develop at the exact same time. And then blood supply enters the bone through this perforating canal right here, and the process accelerates a little bit. All right, now these two centers merge together, right, and we see something that looks like a nice long bone right here with a medullary cavity on the inside, but we still don't have any bone on the tips of the bone. Oh, and I forgot to talk about the tips of a bone. Okay, the ends of the bone, did I mention this? Epiphysis, the epiphyses, yeah, I did. Okay, it's coming back to me. And then the shaft of the bone is called the diaphysis right here. All right, so at this point in time, there's no epiphyseal bone. All right, so this then is what we call the secondary ossification center. So then ossification, there are osteoblasts in this region that start to deposit bone, and then the bone grows to the superficial regions. And then finally, this primary ossification center and secondary ossification center is going to meet right here and form a plate, and we call that the epiphyseal plate. And you can see in a developing individual, what kind of tissue is that? It looks blue to me. Bone kind of looks beige to me. All right, so what is this epiphyseal plate? What kind of tissue is in there? Okay, that is cartilage, hyaline cartilage, which is relatively weak. So the epiphyseal plate is relatively weak tissue, but this is the area where bones then are going to grow in length, okay, from epiphysis to epiphysis, but the collar of the bone is how the bone grows in diameter. Okay, and there's always going to be a balance between two different kinds of cells, the osteoclasts that break bone down within the medullary cavity compared to the osteoblasts that are building bone up here, right, within cortical bone on the cortical surface of the bone. All right, and guess what happens if the activity of the osteoclast is faster than the activity of the osteoblast? What happens to bone when that happens? Right, then you lose bone, right? It becomes very brittle, it dissolves away. So that's the essential problem with osteoporosis, is that a person's osteoclastic activity outpaces the activity of the osteoblasts on the outside of the bone, and then as a result, people lose bone when that happens. Okay, what kind of cells are responsible for making spongy bone right here? Okay, it used to be compact bone, and then it turns into spongy bone. What kind of cell makes spongy bone from compact bone? The osteoclasts do that, so that's their job. Okay. Okay, oppositional growth just refers to the kind of growth where bone is made on one side of a tube but is taken away on the other. So oppositional is by the addition of bone from one side, one edge of a bone, compared to removal of bone from the opposite side of the bone. And that's how a bone grows in which dimension? In length or in diameter? In diameter. So oppositional growth is the kind of growth that you have in a bone, all right, when it's growing in diameter. Remodeling of bones. All right, so your bones are being remodeled all the time. Think of it as like maybe remodeling your house. Before you start to remodel your house, you have to maybe knock some walls out or something. You got to actually rip some things down. And that's the job of these osteoclasts. They break down bone fragments and remove them, just turn them into calcium ions that float around in your bloodstream, used for other purposes. Right? And then osteoblasts move in and deposit new bone matrix where bone should actually be. Okay, and bone will grow in certain areas that are under stress, like where you have an attachment point to a muscle. For instance, where a tendon attaches to a bone, it's going to get bigger and stronger in that area. And this process is basically happening over your whole life period, right? So that you have a new skeleton every 5 years. But if you ever damage a bone, this process of remodeling takes between 4 and 6 weeks, right? Where it's accelerated in a place where you have a fracture. All right, so let's talk about bone repair due to a fracture. So when you break a bone, the first thing that happens are these blood vessels are damaged and you lose a lot of blood to hemorrhage. But fortunately for most people, that hemorrhage can stop because of coagulation, or it forms a blood clot in bone. And that blood clot is held together with some protein fibers that we call fibrin. They're not a very strong fiber like collagen. So a broken bone is held together very weakly with some of these fibers. They're there mostly to prevent bleeding rather than to hold bone fragments together. Okay? But then, all right, there are the osteoblasts that move in and start to lay down collagen. And the collagen then kind of glues the bone fragments together so that they don't migrate around and lacerate a nerve or a blood vessel. That thing is very weak. It's called a callus. So a callus is something that develops after maybe about a half a week or so, and it's very delicate. And when a new bone is growing, or when a bone that's broken is repairing itself, that callus is something we don't want to have damaged, which is one reason why, right, if the swelling has gone away, we cast that area so that the callus isn't damaged. If a callus is repeatedly damaged, then a bone won't ever go back and heal properly. So that's why things are cast. Right, and a callus is just a nice fibrous network. It has some cartilage, but right, a mature callus does have collagen fibers, which holds the bone fragments together. Then osteoblasts start to deposit new hydroxyapatite, which is the strong material, as well as more collagen. And then this process is completed in about 6 weeks, as long as you give that bone plenty of time to rest and recuperate, as long as you don't damage the callus when it's being repaired. Okay, so there are some bones that we don't cast, like bones, for instance, in your toes, right? But nonetheless, right, when that broken toe is healing, you shouldn't stretch it. You shouldn't stress it any which way or the other. That's why when you have a broken toe, a physician says the best way to get a toe healed is bed rest for how long? 6 weeks. Okay? Who can stay in bed for 6 weeks? Well, there's nobody. So what happens to your toe? It never really ever heals right, but there are some nifty techniques that are used. There's special casts, there's walking casts, which try to take the pressure off of your toes when you're walking. But usually if you have a broken toe, it takes a little bit longer than 6 weeks to heal. Because why? You can't do bed rest for 6 weeks. Okay. So that's it for the opening chapter for skeletal tissues. All right, so come with questions next time. Oh, Monday. Don't come Monday. I won't answer any questions on Monday, so there's no sense showing up, right? Because I won't come because Monday is a holiday, right? But we will have a lecture. Yeah, I know, that's really nice. It's a holiday for teachers, too, right? So don't forget, our next lecture will be on Wednesday of next week, okay? Here's a sign-in sheet if you need to sign in. And don't forget, this is your receipt for being in class. So please always sign in.